The next case is 03-1973, State of Ohio versus John Mayo. Ms. Ingram.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. I'd like to ask to reserve 2 minutes to rebut.
Watch your time.
Thank you. We know John Mayo was drunk when he plowed through a row of orange barrels on I-75 in Dayton and struck and killed a construction worker, 30-year-old Lorna Dinges. We know that because a blood alcohol test taken shortly after the crash at Miami Valley Hospital for his diagnosis and treatment showed his blood alcohol level to be 0.207. We also know that test result was accurate. People who took the test were qualified. The people that ran the test were qualified and followed the procedures. The doctors and nurses at the hospital were willing to rely on the results of that blood test to make their decisions concerning treatment, diagnosis and treatment for John Mayo. And we know that those test results are not subject to the physician-client privilege as a result of the amendment made to Revised Code 2317.02, which is, I believe, B1C. But in this case, those test results, as reliable and relevant and unprivileged as they were, are not admissible because, according to the Court of Appeals, the state was unable to show in this prosecution for aggravated vehicular homicide based on a violation of 4511.19a that those test results were produced in compliance with regulations promulgated by the Director of Health that 4511.19d refers to. But it's the state's position that that is a misreading of the statute. When 4511d was enacted, the only kinds of blood or bodily fluid test results that were going to be available were those produced through implied consent 4511.191. At that time, medical test results were subject to the physician-client privilege. So that when that statute was enacted, in 4511.19d, when the statute refers to such bodily substances must be analyzed in conformity with regulations promulgated by the Director of Health, that could only refer to bodily fluid substances that were taken and tested through Ohio's implied consent law. Now, in the mid-80s, there were a number of courts in Ohio, courts of appeals and trial courts, who decided to make their own policy exception to the privilege and held that these test results, the cost of keeping them out was greater than the good the privilege promoted. Now, this court put paid to that in State versus Smorgala and found that the courts were without the ability to exempt these kind of test results from the privilege. But the legislature did just that in 2317.02b1c. The legislature enacted a section that made those test results admissible in prosecutions. Let me back up for a second. Records or communications that would ordinarily be privileged under the physician-client privilege were now exempted from that privilege in prosecution, in criminal prosecutions involving the content of alcohol, presence or amount of drugs, alcohol, or both in bodily fluids. So that what the General Assembly did when they enacted that statute was to make available an entire set of test results that weren't available when 4511 19D was enacted and written that, so that it said such bodily substances shall be analyzed. Now, I point out also that I think that the reason there was no, you know, concomitant amendment to 4511-19D was that those courts of appeals that were allowing, that had abrogated the privilege for that short period of time, that evidence was getting in. So I suspect, or I suggest, that there was no need seen to change or amend 4511-19D because it appeared simply obvious that with the privilege removed, these medical test results would now be admitted just as if they were any other scientific test results and were no longer, or were not, I'm sorry, and were simply not subject to the requirements of 4511-19D, which says that the test must be conducted in conformity with the regulations of the Director of Health. That's the substance of my argument. And it is on that basis I'm asking this court to reverse the Court of Appeals. Now, in Mail's brief and in the brief on behalf of Amicus, the argument's made that it's as if, you know, through a number of years, a clear path has kind of been hacked through the thicket of the DUI statutes, and that to decide the way that I'm asking the court to decide today will simply be unworkable and will lead once again to mass confusion and create all kinds of difficulties. And I submit that's not the case. If the court were to rule as I'm going to ask them to, as I'm asking them to today, then the court would not have to overrule or discredit or cast any kind of backward glance, actually, to any of the cases it's decided, such as Burnside or Steele or Plummer or Newark versus Lucas, because this case, to decide the way I'm asking you to, would require you to distinguish those cases. None of those cases involved medical tests. They all involved tests that were taken submitted for testing under 4511.191. They were all implied consent. None of those cases involved tests taken by qualified medical personnel in certified qualified hospital labs tested there. The results are, I mean, the doctors and nurses were prepared to rely on those results to decide his diagnosis and treatment, to base all kinds of decisions on. Certainly if they are that reliable and that accurate, they're accurate enough for the jury to, they're accurate enough to come into evidence without the requirements of following the regulations of the Director of Health.
May I ask, if they're introduced in a per se violation case, what is the opportunity of defense counsel to cross-examine with respect to how test in the hospital was administered?
Well, I think in either the per se or the A1 violation, it would be when the witness is called upon the stand to testify at trial. That would be the foundational requirement for the state to show, just like the state would have to show before it introduced the results of any other scientific test, that the test is reliable, that it's accepted, that there are certain standards for running the test, that this person followed those standards.
The defendant here, as you know, points out in his brief that the way in which the blood was drawn in the hospital is quite different from the test that follows the standards of the administrative code. And so that could be presented to a fact finder.
That there is a protocol for following,
that's
and
right.
That in this particular case,
was not followed in the hospital for taking the blood, whereas it would have been if the blood had been ordered taken by an arresting officer or by the state.
If there was a basis to show that kind of evidence was relevant, for example, that had they followed this protocol, that they would have gotten a more accurate result, then perhaps that would have been available. But why would we ask our hospitals to follow those kinds of procedures? Obviously, those kind of procedures are, they make a lot of sense.
Because the statute seems to say that when someone is charged with driving under the influence or the say violation, that the admission of a test that's taken has to follow certain guidelines. And that's a policy given by the General Assembly. And so wouldn't that be a reason that if we're going to introduce evidence taken in a hospital, that if it doesn't follow that protocol, that's subject to, and the fact finder should know that?
It might be relevant. It might be relevant, but it would not be, it would go to the weight,
sure,
but not the admissibility.
Sure. Right.
And so, yes, it's possible. Yes, I think possibly they could. That might be admissible. The result of a decision like this is in a case where we have accurate and reliable evidence of intoxication, we're not going to be permitted to put that evidence in. And I'd point out that from the very beginning of this case, the state has argued that it is not required to comply with 4511.19d. Now, we've presented the court with several arguments, and the law has also changed during this case, particularly with this court's decision in Burnside. Prior to Burnside being decided, it appears that courts and prosecutors too believed that substantial compliance left a lot wider field than it did. Now it's quite clear that substantial compliance, when that suits, is only a de minimis. So when this case started out, the law's changed a little bit since then, but I would note that in just after the hearing, the state filed a brief citing Haffey versus Cleveland, which was an early case that held for the idea that the state simply did not have to comply with the show compliance with ODH regulations. I'd also say I know that there is some question as to whether or not there should be a difference between prosecutions under A1, which is under the influence, and the per se violations. My position is that doesn't make a difference when we're dealing with medical testimony, such as at issue here, that 4511D, those prohibitions are applicable only in implied consent cases, that medical test results come in as any other scientific test results would come in, and that being the case, that this division that some courts have found that say you really need less than strict compliance with in an A1 prosecution, I think that unless this court that just doesn't apply. This comes in across the board, for what it's worth, in prosecutions with medical records, per se violations or A1 violations. There's a footnote in Newark versus Lucas that I sort of think prevents me from arguing that there is a difference. Because what I'm saying is that in these hospital tests, the state is never going to be able to show compliance with those regulations because, number one, the lab director is not going to have a lab director permit issued by the director of health. The operators aren't going to have those kinds of permits. And if it's a blood serum test, who knows whether or not there's a solid anticoagulant used. The nurses or whoever takes the blood don't write the suspect's name, as the regulations say. They write the patient's name. So that there's never going to be that kind of compliance, so that medical tests are simply exempted, whether it's A1 or one of the per se violations. So I would say that I think footnote 7 in that case, which has been referred to numerous times, is probably dicta, but if the court's willing to endorse that as the holding of the case, it's that there's no actual real difference, that even if it's outside of the two-hour limit, that the state still must show compliance, strict compliance with all of the other regulations, that doesn't defeat my argument because I'm saying we're exempted completely. The state believes that this case should be remanded, although the defense counsel asked that if the court were to rule in our favor, that it be sent back for decision on the other aspects of the motion to suppress. I point out to the court that the trial court overruled the motion to suppress, addressing specifically the issues under 4511.19 and holding in the state's favor, did not specifically mention the other aspects of the motion to suppress the statements or physical evidence. Those were not presented to the Court of Appeals as assignments of error, and they've been abandoned, so there's no need to send this back for decision on that aspect of the case. For that reason, I'd ask the court to reverse and reinstate the conviction and the license suspension. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chief Justice, the remaining members of the court, good morning. I'm here on behalf of John Mail, the appellee in this case. And while it's fresh in my mind, I'd like to deal with last things first. Counsel for the state asked this court that if it does in fact reverse the decision of the Court of Appeals, that the remand go to the trial court. And perhaps in doing so, misunderstood the argument I was making in my brief, and that is that there are two other issues that were raised in the Court of Appeals that the Court of Appeals ignored because it felt that they were moot in light of its ruling. So what I'm asking this court, in the event that you do reverse the Court of Appeals decision with regard to the 4511.19d issue, there are still two other significant issues that still remain to be decided by the Court of Appeals that have absolutely nothing to do with the blood test. I have maintained both in my memorandum opposing jurisdiction and in my merit brief that the state has waived the argument that it now presents to this court. In the trial court, the state presented a lot of evidence and testimony in an attempt to show substantial compliance with the regulations that they now argue don't apply. In their argument to the trial court, the argument was that the regulations don't apply because they don't apply in aggravated vehicular homicide cases. Not the distinction that's being made here now. Not they don't apply because the blood was tested by a hospital lab. Just simply relying on State versus Davis, a previous Second District Court of Appeals decision, under a previous version of the aggravated vehicular homicide statute that said that the regulations don't apply in a prosecution for aggravated vehicular homicide. As was argued in the Court of Appeals, the aggravated vehicular homicide statute itself had changed in the interim and now requires as an element that there be proof of a violation of 4511.19. So the argument that I made in the Court of Appeals as the appellant was that Davis is old law, the 2903.06 is old law that Davis was dealing with, and that's the argument that the state defended in the Court of Appeals. Still insisting that the regulations don't apply in an aggravated vehicular homicide prosecution, never once raising an issue distinguishing the manner in which the blood sample is acquired, whether it's at the request of a police officer or whether it was at the as part of the standard hospital protocol. Neither Judge Gorman in the trial court nor the Court of Appeals ever had the opportunity to deal with the issue that's now in front of this court. So for those reasons, I would continue to maintain that the state has waived that issue. Going beyond that, the state's argument is basically, hey, this was a hospital test. It's got to be reliable. There's no need to resort to the regulations that the Director of Health has promulgated. Who says it's accurate and reliable? We get back into a situation that it appears this court has been trying to get away from for many years, and that is having a battle of experts on the stand to say, well, maybe if it didn't comply with this regulation, it's still reliable because. And that still leaves poor Judge Gorman, who, like myself, has a JD and not an MD, trying to figure out what is reliable, what isn't reliable. And in Burnside, this court made it very clear that that's not supposed to be, that the judges aren't supposed to have to make those reliability determinations, that the Director of Health is the official in our state government to whom the General Assembly has delegated the powers to make those types of medical decisions. I don't believe the statute can even be read in the manner in which the state seeks to have this court read it. And the statute I'm talking about, obviously, is 4511.19D. There are three paragraphs there. And the first one deals with specifically that for a violation of the DUI statute, the court may admit evidence on concentration of alcohol in defendant's blood, breath, urine, or other bodily substance as shown by chemical analysis of the blood, urine, breath, or other bodily substance. Now, when you go to the second paragraph upon which the state is hanging its hat here, the part that contains the language, when a person submits to a blood test at the request of a police officer, the words bodily substance or other bodily substance don't appear in that paragraph. So from where I sit, it only makes sense that when the third paragraph is talking about analyzation of such bodily substance, it's obviously referring back to the first paragraph, not the second, just as a matter of plain reading.
Would the state have had any difficulty, or would an officer have been able to go to the hospital while this person was in the hospital and say, can you do a second blood draw pursuant to our regulations and do the test? I mean, could they have done that concurrently with what the hospital did for its own medical treatment?
I don't know. I don't know how far the hospital's lab would have worked with the police officers, if that's what you're asking. I suspect that most hospital labs are independent labs, not owned or actually operated by the hospitals. And perhaps there are some in the state that may serve not only as clinical labs, but as forensic labs.
If there's not a direct control by the hospital over the lab, isn't that even more of a reason to have the Department of Regulations apply to ensure reliability?
Not necessarily. Not necessarily, and I'm not sure if that was a softball to me, but still, not necessarily, because I think the goals of the hospital and the goals of the DUI law are not necessarily the same. The goals in the DUI law are accuracy, reliability, and to a certain extent, as was acknowledged in Burnside, uniformity. We want everybody to know what to expect, what it is, and what the Director of Health feels meets the goals of accuracy and reliability when someone's freedom is on the line. Now, hospitals obviously have goals, too, in terms of accuracy and reliability, so that they can make medical decisions properly and not get sued. But that doesn't necessarily mean that they are the same types of goals. For evidentiary purposes, there are strict rules of law about chain of evidence and things like that. While it would be good practice for a hospital to maintain those same levels of chain of evidence for the next time Dr. X gets sued, maybe that's not a priority in the emergency room. In the emergency room, they want something done, they want it done now, they want to find out, does this guy have any alcohol? Because if he does, we can't give him drug X, Y, or Z. Or they want to find out, does this guy go way off the charts on the other end, in which case we have to treat him for alcohol toxicity. They don't necessarily have to make those fine distinctions in between 0.08 and 0.099. So I guess what I'm struggling with in all of this is, if it's not the Director of Health's regulations, what is it? How do we determine admissibility other than to say, oh, the hospital did it, so it's okay? And what do we do with situations where if someone comes into the hospital and the police officer asks, can I have your permission to have your blood drawn? And he says, sure. And the hospital then goes and tests it. Well, at that point, he's had it drawn at the request of a police officer. What does the hospital do then? If they don't follow the regulations, at that point, according to the state's argument, it's inadmissible. But if they don't follow the regulations, at that point, according to the state's argument, it is admissible. It's a hospital. They're reliable. So what do you do in that type of situation? What do you do in a situation where the hospital draws blood for treatment, and before it's destroyed or disposed of, which apparently they do within a day or two in hospital labs rather than holding them for a year, but before that occurs, the police officer is able to convince a judge to give him a warrant to seize that blood and take it to a private lab for testing. Now, at this point, you've got it drawn for medical purposes, but tested in a private lab. Whose standards apply at that point? I think this just all gets us back into the situation where you're looking at it on a case-by-case-by-case-by-case basis, and that's what this court has tried to avoid.
Counsel, it seems to me that the appellant here is arguing if the draw was at the request of a police officer, then the ODH regs and protocol has to be followed. If it's done for medical reasons, for the at the hospital, not at the request of the police officer, then the hospital analysis protocol is sufficient, and then it becomes an issue for the jury or the judge to determine the reliability of that testing procedure, much the same as you can challenge any other procedure of measurement that is attendant to a traffic violation or any other violation.
That's the argument.
Okay, and so this going back and forth that you're saying what ifs, what ifs, what ifs, I don't think that they're arguing that. I think that they're arguing that you've got two sets of circumstances. Either it's done at the request of law enforcement, or it's done for medical treatment.
My point was, what if it's done at the request of the officer, but instead of being taken to a private forensic lab, the tests that under the state's theory are automatically reliable.
But they're not arguing that that would be permissible. They're not even suggesting that. They're making a kind of a bright line here, whether it's done in one way than private ODH protocol, and if it's done for the purposes of treatment at the institution, the hospital, that's admissible.
I'm having a little trouble here with the light system. Am I out of time?
You have 34 seconds.
Okay.
The yellow light means you have 2 minutes.
Okay,
warning light.
Thank you. Counsel for the state said it herself. There's never going to be compliance by the hospitals unless and until someone tells them there has to be that type of compliance if this is something that's later going to be used for evidentiary purposes. I would suggest to the court that in addition to waiver, the state should not prevail on the merits and that the decision of the Court of Appeals should be upheld. Thank you for your time and attention.
Thank you, Mr. Hempling. Ms. Ingram, you've used your time, but you may take 30 seconds. Let me start you with a question. 06 says, of course, you can't operate a motor vehicle, injure someone, as the proximate result of committing a violation of Division A of Section 4511.19. Go to 4511.19, and it tells us how you can prove that there's a violation of Division A. There is a bit of a gap because the General Assembly didn't seem to anticipate this situation, this circumstance. But isn't the only way you can, the only way one can prove a violation of Division A of 4511.19 is by following the protocol in that section, in that code, in A and D, is it not?
If it is an implied consent test, that is correct. The only way you can prove it. However, if the test results have been obtained because they were done for medical diagnosis and treatment, then they are not privileged and they are not otherwise prohibited from admissibility by 4511.19D.
Except that 06 seems to want the proof to be pursuant to Division A of 4511 of 19, which of course refers to D, refers to A. It with the gap, there is a, I admit there's a gap here, but it seems to me that the General Assembly wants the proof of 06 to be pursuant to 19A. And you find out how you comply with A, or how you prove A, by looking at D. And D doesn't say anything about introducing evidence from a hospital.
Right. That's right. I guess I don't understand.
So don't we have to make a big jump to get where you take us?
No. No, because what I'm saying is that language that talks about proof, how you prove it, right, that was enacted with reference to the only kind of bodily substance evidence that was available at that time. I agree that if we are to prove aggravated vehicular homicide as charged in the indictment in this case, we must prove every element of the underlying 4511.19A violation, whether or not it's one, two, or five, whichever one it is. I also think the Court of Appeals was incorrect in saying that we were required to elect in the indictment which subsection we were going to go under, because the statute, Criminal Rule 7 says simply in terms of the, or 6 is in terms of the statute is sufficient. But I think my argument, which is that if it's taken for medical diagnosis or treatment, it is not subject to the requirements promulgated by the Director of Health. It's simply out of the equation. And the subsection D, which tells how to prove it, refers only to implied consent cases. Then we can prove in prosecution for aggravated vehicular homicide, we can prove the underlying 4511.19 violation by proof of medic, but with the admission, through the admission of medical tests done for medical diagnosis or treatment. And that medical diagnosis and treatment is what is the bright line between some of the hypotheticals. If the officers went back and asked the hospital to run another test, it's not for diagnosis or treatment. If the officers seized a test with a search warrant, then and sent it in for evaluation through a private lab, then already there's been violations of
your argument leaves us with two different individuals being treated differently under the law, doesn't it? With different protections. If someone is arrested at the road and pulled over at the roadside, and then they are tested pursuant to point 19, they receive this protection that the administrative service or the administrative rule provides. Somebody is injured and goes to the hospital, as they do here, they don't receive that same protection, if that's what it's called, if that's what we can call it.
For example, if that person at the hospital refuses the request for the officer's request, so we've now refused, we don't have an implied consent blood test, and he's required to give blood as part of his medical diagnosis and treatment, then the state has access to that. Yeah, and I think Mayo points that out in his brief, and that is, you know, it doesn't come out even that way. But I think that anomaly is less striking than the anomaly of reading the statute in such a way that prevents the state from introducing reliable, accurate, unprivileged evidence of intoxication, or at least preventing the state from even laying the foundation to introduce that at trial. I'm not backing off from State versus Davis, and I would only point out that in State versus Davis, all the discussion about aggravated vehicular homicide and the old statute is beside the point, because he was convicted of involuntary manslaughter, which did depend on the state's proof of a violation of 4511.19.
Ms. Ingram, would you address the waiver issue, please?
From the very beginning, the state has argued that either A, it wasn't required to do anything more than substantially comply, and bearing in mind that at the time this hearing was set, what substantial compliance looked like, we had a wider path than Burnside made clear. But we also argued the state didn't have to show compliance, and we cited, I will agree, this argument did not figure as prominently as it does now, but we argued that compliance was not necessary at all, citing State versus Haffey, and I think that is in like the next to last paragraph, no, it's Cleveland versus Haffey. Next to last paragraph in a memo filed by the state right after the hearing, like maybe April 29th. So we did cite that. But this is, like many cases, the issues do sharpen over the course of the prosecution. And in addition to this, the law changed over the course of the prosecution. And during that period of time, there were, until this court decided Burnside, there were courts competing views about how what amounted to substantial compliance, and is there a difference in A1 prosecutions versus the per se prosecutions. So this argument is perhaps, you know, really most sharply drawn right now, but it's not that it was never raised.
Thank you. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion. The marshal, please adjourn court.
All rise.